You're listening to The Art of the Hustle, the show that breaks down how the world's most fascinating people have hustled their way to the top. I'm your host, Jeff Rosenthal, co-founder of Summit and co-owner of Powder Mountain Ski Resort in Utah. And today I'm sitting down with someone who has truly mastered the art of the hustle, from starting his company in his parents' basement in 2012 to recently selling it to one of the top multinational food manufacturers in the world, protein bar master chef and incredible entrepreneur, Peter Rahal. For those listening, Peter is one of the co-founders of RX Bar, a protein bar company known for its delicious, natural ingredients and no BS mantra. If there's anyone who understands the sacrifice, perseverance, and passion it takes to hustle your way to the top, it's Peter. With that said, please help me welcome to the studio today, Peter Rahal. How are you, Peter? Thank you for being on.
Thank you.
You know, we've only gotten to talk a couple of times, but I've been blown away by the company that you and Jared built at RX Bar. Thank you for making a delicious and healthy product for us.
Thank you.
Of course. And how many people now are at RX Bar?
Today we're about 200 people full-time, and then we have two offices, one in Chicago here and then one in the UK.
And where are most of the bars manufactured these days?
We have a couple locations manufacturing it, but most of them are in beautiful Southern California.
Lovely. You know, I know you started the business in 2012, and I thought a fun way for us to just kick it off would be, you know, starting there. And bring us back there. And you and Jared grew up together, correct?
Correct. Yeah. First grade, we've met Mrs. Parisi's class and been friends ever since.
Awesome. I love that. What were you doing before RX Bar?
I grew up in the food business on the supply side. My family has a business called Rahal Foods that supplies industrial fruit products like juice concentrate, IQF, fruits, and purees. And then, so I grew up in that business. And then I was working for a transportation brokerage, like a startup. Organization was like 4 or 5 people. That was my job before I started RX Bar. And it was quite miserable. I learned a lot through that experience.
I'm sure. And I know you're from Illinois and you went to Wittenberg University in Ohio. And when you were growing up, did you have like any entrepreneurial, starts? Is this something that was like in your bones, or was RX Bar your first real venture?
Yeah. So as a child, I was super commercial, like very. And I was always building things, whether that's a fort or, you know, building skateboards and selling them, making airplanes, rockets. I was always building things and then always into like the transactions, so like trading and buying, selling, et cetera. But then when I got to the age, like I had started two other businesses before that both like failed. One was a sleep aid shot. And the other one was a coffee donut shop that they actually never even got off the ground, but they're failures for sure. That really, like, I learned a shitload from.
And take us to, why protein bars? Why RX Bar? Mm-hmm. What was the inspiration?
So bars, when you think about bars, they have a ton of utility in the sense that like they can be for breakfast, they're on the go, they're mobile, they're like a whole meal, or they're a snack. And you think about like one of the main jobs they do as a form is they like save time. You don't have to prep them. You grab them, they're stable. You just eat it. And so I, as a like consumer in the world, like always loved bars. I've been consuming them since like high school, the old Detour bars before workouts or whatever. And as I got educated in nutrition, a simple question was like, why are all the protein bars like full of shit? There's like these gas station ones that are like 30 grams that are just, you just don't know what's in them. And they're just, the ingredient list is like daunting. And then there's natural ones that don't have any protein or no substance. And so that was the question. And that's why I was like, all right, well, there's gotta be a better way to make one. So that was the idea. And actually, like, I remember I was at work, my old company, and I remember seeing an article from like Inc. or like entrepreneur saying like start a nutrition bar company with $10,000 or something like that, you know, like one of those like clickbait titles. And it just showed you, it was basically saying like how you can make it in your kitchen and sell it. And I remember sending that article to Jared and be like, look, you know, and it's just funny when you think of like those back in those days, like the business is so fragile. Like if the wind blows a certain way or whatever, like you just don't do it. You know what I mean? You could just, it's so fragile. You could just decide like, I don't want to do this. But anyway, that was the bit of the origin of like.
Incredible. And did you start? Is that how it began? You guys started making bars in the kitchen?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Incredible. And I remember when we first chatted, it blew my mind that, you know, 6 years earlier, 6 years ago, you were literally hand pressing bars like in your parents' house, correct?
Yeah. Even better in their basement.
Oh, I love it. Okay, perfect. But you know, I want to stay in this phase when you guys were, you know, just starting it and mixing product and testing bars. And like what were the points where you did you raise capital at that point? Did you like build the brand out first? Did you already have a name?
So we started with the product first, designing the product. Cause like we are in the product business. That's like the most important thing. And the strategy. So if you look back, thinking back to 2012, I remember we went to like, we walked through Whole Foods or, you know, Kroger, these stores, and we're like overwhelmed with how many options were out there. And so we knew we had to find a different distribution alternative. And we were both really into CrossFit and just fitness in general and sports, athletics, and saw a really alternative distribution strategy in terms of like selling online, kind of bypassing retail and going direct to consumer, and then more importantly, direct to gyms as our customers, and gyms and meaning mostly CrossFit gyms. And so our distribution strategy and just the business plan, how we go to market, shaped and defined our whole business. So from like our cap table to our manufacturing strategy, to our branding, to everything. And so we actually named the brand after our distribution strategy in a sense, or really like our early adopters being CrossFit. So like RX and CrossFit is a signal of health. It's a signal of high standards. And it's in the culture, like language wise. So that was like our origin, and the whole plan was like, how do we get our business going, get volume up to a certain point, then how do we cross the chasm to like the natural channel, conventional, and then broader retail. And so because we went direct to consumer and we manufacture the product ourselves, so one, manufacturing the product yourselves is brutal. Most people would be like, oh, why are you doing that? You got to grow, outsource it, et cetera. But what it allowed us to do is control our inventory, both finished product and raw materials. And when you're able to do that, you can control your cash flow much better. So we never had to deal with significant amounts of inventory or cash in inventory. So we'd go essentially, think about it as like, we make a batch, we sell a batch. Whereas like if you commercialize with a co-manufacturer and outsource it, you immediately have like, you know, 300,000 bars, so like 90 to 120 days of inventory on hand, and that requires a ton of cash.
Yeah.
So that's one. And then two, because it was direct to consumer, we got an order, we got paid credit via credit card, and then we shipped it. So literally we had like our payment terms were like one day.
I love that. I know the answer, but how did you guys design your logo? Did you go to like some fancy advertising agency?
No. So I remember going on Microsoft Word, opening up a doc, typing it in RX bar as many, like using all the fonts on Microsoft Word and just seeing which one looked the best. And I remember looking at it, be like, which one is like a little bit athletic? You know what I mean? And if you look at our other angle, it's like slightly like leaning forward, not too aggressive, but yet a little aggressive. So that was our process. And the thing is, it was just like, let's just go. We know we were going to change, like where you start, not where you finish, but we just wanted to get to market, move fast, and sell product.
And is it true that you used to put your cell phone on the back of the original packaging?
Yeah, for sure. It's not only that, it was website, LinkedIn, everything.
And it was your cell phone, your personal cell phone.
The same cell phone I'm on right now.
No way. Wow. So the listeners can look back and figure out how to call you today. That's great.
Yeah.
No.
But that's a good story because that's like a principle of the company. Like, we're servants to our customers. And if anyone has any question about whether our almonds are roasted or not, or if they wanted to place an order or whatever, like, there should be zero friction for them to get to us. And at the time, we didn't have an office, but for us, we needed to serve our customers.
And you wanted them to see that you were totally accessible. And I guess, speaking of that, you know, it says it on the label, no BS. Do you mind elaborating on the significance of that as, you know, part of your brand?
Yeah. So when we first were making the packaging on PowerPoint, when you design a product like the way ours is designed, there's a ton of claims. For example, we could claim gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, non-GMO, no added sugar, high protein. And so we were writing like no soy, no dairy, no gluten, or no grains, no soy, no dairy. And then it just like flew off our tip of our tongue, like no BS. And so that was our master claim back in the day, but it was more like a wink. You know what I mean? It wasn't like pound the chest, no BS. And it's also kind of the brand's personality, just like very direct, honest. And I would describe our culture that way. In the same way. So like the product, brand, and culture kind of all are in sync. And so, yeah, there's like, we're very just honest, I would say.
And as you were going through the process, so you've like built the brand, you're, you know, selling product, you've built this new, you know, distribution, you know, system through the gyms and through the health and wellness space, as opposed to purely through the Whole Foods of the world. And you were clearly early to thinking about, you know, selling online and building an online direct to consumer brand. Is there a moment that you remember when you were really like, okay, chapter one's in the books? Like, was there a big client or a big order or a national expansion? Like, when did you take it to the next level for the first time?
There's like multiple massive inflection points through the journey. Like, the commercialization process was a huge one. Stop making it from like our kitchen, scaled kitchen to a proper food manufacturing plant was a huge one.
Around what time was that?
That was May 2014. And then another huge milestone was getting Trader Joe's distribution. To give you an idea, like, the reason why that was so meaningful is for the first time when someone said, oh, where can I get an RX bar? Like, our reaction wasn't like, well, where do you live? Because before, you know, most retailers are very regional. So you'd have to like, okay, where do you live here? Okay, well, this place has them. You know what I mean? So this first time I could think, oh, you can get them at Trader Joe's. And so I was our first like national account, I'd say. I mean, we were everywhere, but it was a really important distribution deal for us. And then another thing that's significant about that from a milestone perspective is that if you look at Trader Joe's business, it's 90% private label. And the only set in the grocery store that isn't is really, I mean, there's a couple other ones, but the bar space in particular isn't. There's not much private label in there. And the only participants in that category are like the winners. Like, to get into Trader Joe's bar is like a big signal, because it's like Cliff, Kind, Quest, like the top dogs in there. And so we were in there. So that was like a huge, like, oh shit, here we go.
And is there a bit of a gatekeeper? I mean, I imagine a lot of those relationships go way back for Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and all these people. Did you guys have to like break down some walls, or was the product just better?
It's a combination of both. You have to navigate, you know, it's enterprise sales, and then, but the product, you know, was hunting too. So it all has to align. It's kind of like planetary alignment. You can't do one without the other.
And it's really incredible to me, man. Like, I typically see, you know, like these two different eras. There's like startup founders, it's like ingenuity and a visionary capacity and, you know, willingness to take like big risk and all that stuff. And often those don't translate down the road. And clearly you know, started the company and stewarded it, you know, for the last 7 years and have been able to scale your ability to match what you were facing in the business. How much of that was like your personal growth, and how much of it has been like building your team and learning how to manage?
Yeah. I mean, me as a leader, I'm like a different human being than I was 7 years ago, for sure. It's been that much of a stimulus for growth personally for me. And the way I think about it is, after the first year is like survival. Like, the company's going to die. Your job is to survive and prove the concept. And then once you get past the survival phase, as a CEO at least, your job becomes like, if we shift from being in the bar business and surviving to like being in the people business, because you can't do this alone. And it, literally to get to the next level and to really adapt and learn, it is all about the building an organization and building teams. And when you think about all like great sales strategy, great marketing, great, you know, generating demand, supply, financing the business, like those are all outcomes of what teams do. And so like all a company is a group of humans that make decisions together and identify problems, make decisions, and it's really all it is. And so if you want to be a great company, you better be really good at doing that and having teams that do that. So that became a focus. Once I connected the dots, that really became a focus to build an amazing culture, amazing organization, and to reap the benefits. We reap the benefits of it, and our customers have.
And I've heard that, you know, as we've been doing our research, you know, for, you know, thank you for, you're going to be speaking at a summit event here pretty soon. And so I have the additional benefit of learning, you know, in a deep way about your company. And what, you know, some of your employees have told us is that it's a very atypical leadership style that you've historically really sort of like shaved the pedestal down, not built it up. Whereas many founders, especially in CPG, tend to want to be the center of attention. Tell us about that a little bit. Is that just natural for you, or is that something that you learned to do?
I think it was the benefit of just starting very humbly here. You know, like in parents' basement, like you get respect one for that. And then Jared and I, you know, we did every task in the company. So like we had the empathy for like all parts of the business, from manufacturing to finance, like the whole thing. And then a value, like bringing back to like the phone number on the package, like one of the company's values is a servant mindset. And so that value, that like the leadership we prescribe here is really like a servant leadership. And so that to me comes natural, and it's the way I grew up. For those of you that know, like love languages, it's like my love language. So like service, being a servant makes me happy. And then as a leader, like I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty. I'm not afraid to like dive in and help. And then I'm not afraid to stay high and at a visionary level either. So that like leadership agility is important. And, you know, people, I think, want to work with someone who's going to like get their hands dirty and get the fuck out of the way too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, boost them up and give them the space to be the superstar in the organization. You don't always have to be Jordan.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of, how did you and Jared, how did you divide responsibilities?
Yeah. So it was very natural. Cause the good thing, like the reason why you work with your friends is because you have rapport, right? Like we've known each other. And I'm pretty like unreliable. He's very reliable. I'm creative. He's less creative. And so like the commercial side of the business was more my strengths. And then the operational, like finance accounting side of the business was more his strengths. And there was like, he's a super self-aware person. And so am I. So it was a very natural, like, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And it was a very collaborative relationship. So meaning like, we never took credit for things. It was more, we're doing this together, and you got that, I got that, but we're doing it.
And I also have been told by, you know, people that know you well, that the intention of this was never to get rich. That wasn't like why you guys got into business. Clearly, you know, you have an entrepreneurial spirit, and I know that you weren't intending to sell the company. But you guys sold to Kellogg, correct?
Correct.
Okay, awesome. So I'm just curious, like how did that transition? Like why did you guys decide to sell? And first and foremost, one, how did you make that decision? And then two, what were you looking for in a potential buyer?
Yeah, so Jared and I wanted like to make a better product, one, and then two, like just build a great company and focus on like the fundamentals of what creates value in a business. And that's why we built a self-reliant business. That's why we kept improving our product. And then as we went on and started taking off, the question was like, what do we want? Where do we want to be when we grow up as a business? And
the way we thought about it is like there's two paths: either stay private and keep this a family business, or to go public and or roll into another bigger organization. And for us, Jared and I both have bad experiences with nepotism in family businesses, and I didn't really want to pass this down or hold on forever. And so that was kind of like a no from both of our perspectives. And so we're looking at going to a bigger company, so like a public company or going to a strategic. And for us, it wasn't like, hey, we're going to go do this. It was more like, let's go see what this is like. And like in terms of, let's go talk to a couple strategics and see if we're aligned philosophically and from a business perspective. And then, so we just went on a couple dates. And I would say from an food entrepreneur's perspective, you look at the big CPG companies, the big food companies, and they kind of have this like misconception that they're like evil food companies or something. And then once you get under the covers, they're actually totally not. They're usually very mission driven and actually trying to do good. I think some of their portfolio is a little bit outdated, and that's what people I think judge them by. But so we had the same misconception, and then as soon as we started going a couple of dates, we realized like, oh my gosh, like they're not, it's just not true. They're not these like evil companies. So then, and then we just went through the process, and what we were looking for in a partner or someone to buy us was kind of three things. One is like value, so making sure we get the most value for the business. Two, alignment on values and philosophies, like how to work and how to run the business. And then three, an operating model. We didn't want someone who's like, we're going to integrate you and fire everyone and just roll you into the company. We wanted to protect our people and execute our vision.
You recently, or maybe you recently stepped down as a CEO, correct? Or you're going to very soon?
Yeah, I stepped down, I think like 3 weeks ago.
Oh man, amazing. Well, one, yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
What are you going to focus on? What are you thinking? Are you going to do a little Eat, Pray, Love life, or what's up?
So I'm going to help my successor, Jim Murray, the president, like get up to speed and be there as of service to help him think through the leadership team. And so just help through succession, helping Kellogg with innovation broadly and portfolio strategy. And then for me, I'm eventually going to move on. I'm a pure entrepreneur, I think. And I just got to go create something else. I do best in the early stages and when there's more risk on the line. And I'm a creator, so I need to get back to like a blank canvas. And so I'm in the process of figuring out my next move.
And is there a space in particular that's interesting to you, or a set of spaces?
Yeah, I think, you know, I like to think I'm agnostic to the world in terms of where, you know, I'm not like going to stay in an industry necessarily, but I do have a lot of food experience. I'm interested in human beings and I call it consumer sciences. So the understanding of humans and consumers. So I just want to solve another problem. So right now I'm just going to learn, collect as much information as possible and see if I can find another problem to solve.
Well, it's incredible. In CPG, I read, and this fact could be totally wrong because I just read it, but I did read that CPG companies, specifically food and bev, typically spend about 2% of revenue investments on R&D, whereas like tech is more like 13 to 15%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we clearly need, you know, folks like yourself out there, you know, taking on these new challenges and helping us bring these new products to market. And to that end, you know, I'm curious, just for you personally, what are some of your first principles that you bring to, you know, all these different projects and people?
I think something I've discovered is the most important thing in business, leadership, innovation is intellectual humility. Humility broadly, and the way I define it is freedom from your pride and arrogance. And so when you approach a problem, if you approach anything with intellectual humility, you usually get a better outcome. And so for me, whatever I do in the future, and when I think about my peers, relationships, personally, professionally, that it is like the most important thing. And here's the thing, is like all humans, we battle with pride naturally. Like it's not like you it's not a binary thing. And arrogance in particular, like it's, you're at war with it every day. So for me, the principle in life, or a value that is I live by that is super important, top of mind, is that.
And in terms of just like building skills that you didn't have or like things that you wanted to grow on, I know that you used to be less comfortable public speaking than you are today. And like, as your company scaled, I assume that that need for you to be able to address the 200 people and, you know, be the charismatic leader when you're, it seems like your nature is to reduce the pride and arrogance, not promote it. How did you learn that? How did you gain that skill?
So public speaking, yeah, it's definitely not natural to me, but through repetition, I'm way more comfortable with it. So like the funny thing is, you know, first the company, we get like six employees or six team members, like doing a town hall there is like super easy. It's like a big meeting. And then when you get 12 people, it's like a little nervous, but easier. So the fact that we've grown, you know, like to 20 people, 30 people, 50 people, 70 people, 120, then 200, like it helped condition. It was like adding resistance to it. So it made it easier over time. But yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty introverted inward thinker and worker. So it's exhausting for me, but it's an important part of leadership to influence and rally the troops and communicate a vision. But I definitely have a lot more, more to improve on.
Were there some close calls or some final Fridays where you thought you were going to lose it?
I mean, I'm sure you have the shared experience, like throughout the process of growing a business, like it is nothing but mistakes. And I think the key thing is your ability to learn from them, identify them, and just mitigate them from happening again. I mean, that's really all it is. It's just like trial, error, iterate, like keep moving. We did have like one really significant near-death experience, and that was when we commercialized to a co-man. So like going from making 10,000 bars at a kitchen to making 150,000 bars with a co-manufacturer, that process, like I was not prudent. I didn't plan. I didn't test. And it was like we were way too overly reactionary. And that was one of the most powerful lessons I've ever learned, because like I'm not a natural planner. I'm very like good in ambiguity. And then I realized like, holy shit, the business needs proper planning. You need to think about the future. And the lesson I learned is like the overarching like principles, like if you're in an overly reactionary state, like just reacting to shit, you are probably missing something really important. I mean, that means you're not doing things that are important, that are like not urgent.
Totally. You're filling your day with all the stuff that seems like it could be accretive instead of, you know, thinking, I love the term post-mortem, pre-mortem. I only learned this recently, but pre-mortem is looking at all the things that could go wrong with a particular project. So you can sort of start to tease out the potential, you know, unknown unknowns that could come your way.
100%.
That's not natural for me at all either. I'm
no
ready, fire, aim guy myself. Incredible, man. Well, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, in 2012, if somebody, I'm sure you went to a bunch of people as investors or potential partners and you're like, I'm going to start, you know, a bar company. And they're like, guy, are you serious? There's 100 of these. Nobody needs this. And of course, no one shared your vision. You know, you and Jared saw this and didn't take no for an answer and forced this thing into reality, right? Like, do you have any advice for people who have a vision or a project or, you know, something that they see and they believe in, in terms of just like how to break past that initial, maybe even internal gatekeeper?
Yep. So I would say, don't be afraid to start in small markets. Truly don't give a fuck what others think. And then make sure you're solving a problem that exists. I mean, think about my experience. We solved the problem. The world didn't have there wasn't a natural protein bar, or there wasn't a paleo protein bar more specifically. And then the market we started in was a CrossFit gym market, which probably the cap was 10 million in sales. And then it was humiliating to be making bars in my parents' basement with my childhood friend out of like foil lined resealable pouches and selling them online. Like that was not cool. If I cared about what other people thought, if I wanted to pursue a bigger market, if I would have raised money. It just would not have worked. So that's the pattern. You can see this pattern in other businesses too, but you can't care what other people, you can't care what other people think, and you just got to focus on a real problem and then not be scared of small markets.
I love that, man. You're the man. We really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing with us so openly and transparently. And I think that it's super valuable for me as an entrepreneur just to understand more about this. So thanks again, Peter, and best of luck with all your new endeavors. And we really, really appreciate you.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Wow, that was fantastic. I have a lot of respect for Peter and what he's built, what he and his partner Jared have built. It's really a rare thing and they did it fast. I mean, from zero to selling to Kellogg for hundreds of millions of dollars in, 5 years. 5 years is, what is that? That's like 1800 days. So, I mean, pretty unbelievable zero to hero story. And clearly, these guys, they learned a lot on the fly. And what a humble, peaceful leader. So in terms of just, the things that I really took away from this interview, I love his concept of intellectual humility. Freedom from pride and arrogance is how Peter put it. And the idea that, he's always trying to not be the smartest guy in the room. And you often find a very A-B set with leaders like Peter of organizations where they either are trying to, increase their own ego and reinforce their own existing beliefs. And a lot of them have a lot of confirmation bias where like, oh, well, this thing worked out because I thought it was this way. I must be right again. Whereas guys like Peter, are focused on doing the exact opposite and shaving down the pedestal and finding ways in which they aren't right. And oftentimes those are the ones that succeed to a much, much greater degree. I also love his concept of leadership agility. The idea that, what got you here won't get you there. And you have to just be continuously learning into the curve of your business. And ultimately, if you are going to build and succeed and grow, you're going to be over your skis at some point. There's no way to play this game and not be outmatched by, just reality at some point in time when you take that level of risk. I also loved his idea that, it sounds so simple, but businesses need planning. If you are overly reactionary, then you're definitely missing something important. And that's hard. I mean, when you are a startup entrepreneur and you have ingenuity and you can problem solve on the fly, often you'll hope that, that skill set will take you all the way to the promised land. And chances are you're going to get knocked out by something or someone. Like I've personally had, million-dollar hits to the business because, we didn't read a contract properly over 11 years, So I definitely respect that. And then I love, his sort of parting wisdom for all of us. Solve a real problem. Start a company that really focuses on something where there's a real need. And not just because you like it or you're building your own identity into it, but really, really think hard and give it the proper amount of sober attention, whether or not you're solving a real problem. Not being afraid to start small. The fact that his existing market of gyms was limited and that he started in smaller cities in terms of distribution, and that created the groundswell and the platform for him to then scale, nationally. I think that that's a really powerful lesson. And then just, do your best and forget the rest and never surrender forever. He's a guy that didn't say that, but it's clear to me that he's the type of guy that really couldn't care less what we think about him because he knows his values and his character. And there's clearly an integrity to the moves that he was making that, make him able to, take those risks and believe in what they were building. And that's it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning into Art of the Hustle. I'm Jeff Rosenthal and see you next time.